of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Alexandra Fuller's 2001 memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, offered her look back at a firsthand girl's view of life in British-run Rhodesia as it transitioned violently into independent Zimbabwe and civil war played out in nearby Mozambique. It won fans around the world, but her mother was not one of them. In fact, her mother, who refers to Alexandra as Bobo, refers to the bestseller as that awful book. It does present a brutally honest picture of her mom as sometimes unhinged, alcoholic, and racist, but also hardworking and dedicated to their way of life as white Africans. A decade later, Alexandra Fuller examines her mom's life and background in more detail in her latest memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Fuller came to Milwaukee earlier this year for an event at Boswell Book Company, an onstage interview I was fortunate to moderate. I asked her whether she felt she already understood her mother better in the years leading up to this latest book.
I think that there's a myth that writers can choose their stories. I really think the stories choose you, and I think you have to be prepared for them. I'm constantly awake and alert to the fact that every experience I have might one day filter into a book, and you sort of do the research and that sort of thing. But it's a lot like being pregnant, which I imagine you have not been. And in that you can get pregnant quite easily. I've discovered, actually, if you have enough champagne, you can get really pregnant. But just getting pregnant isn't enough to have the baby. Then you got to sit around and get morning sickness and feel like hell, and your feet have to swell up, and you've got to go through some discomfort. But you can't, like, 6 months through a pregnancy go, wow, I am so over this, and start pushing and have a baby. And books are very similar. You can't have gathered all the sort of ingredients for a book and then push and the book come out. The book has to be kind of gestated, really, I think. But right after I'd written Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, my mother was furious, and she didn't talk to me, and she organized boycotts and sanctions against me, which she had learned from the Rhodesians, so she was quite good at them. And no one north of the Limpopo River or south of the equator would talk to me. And her primary objection, other than I made her sound like a racist alcoholic, to which I said, and? But her primary objection was, she said, you know, you never asked me who I am. Well, first of all, her primary objection was that I had written an unauthorized biography of her, and I said, it's not a biography of you, it was my memoir. But Mum and I had always had slight overlapping problems in that regard. I think fairly common to mother-daughter relationships. Took her to Scotland, and I interviewed her. I took her to Scotland because I wanted to be somewhere where it was illegal to have guns and ammunition in the room at the same time. And I asked her, who are you? And she told me, it was like a eugenics lesson. She said, you know, I have 1,000,000% Highland Scottish blood, and, you know, you're not pure blood at all because your father's English, and that just means you're a mongrel, and there's probably Armenian in there somewhere. And so I put these tapes aside, and I didn't listen to them, and then... In 2008, when I had finished writing Colton H. Bryant, I was driving across in the winter from South Dakota to Wyoming in a blizzard and listening to NPR. And Tim O'Brien was being interviewed about the things they carried, which that wonderful short story about Vietnam and the things that soldiers carry in war. And I had just started to think about what would it look like if I was writing a book about Mum. And he talked about the way the things you carry emotionally and physically can kill you or can cure you and say everything there is about you. And in war, of course, you only carry the things absolutely essential to self. And I thought about my mum, and her experience really had been like one long war. And I started to think about the things that she carried. And she carried her books. She carried her dogs. And she carried these orange Le Creuset pots, those enamel pots. And I found myself pulled over in a blizzard in Wyoming in floods of tears thinking about my mother and those pots, because when I thought of her as a mother, as I did when I was writing Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, she was an accumulation of the ways in which she had failed me as a mother. She hadn't been very pampering, I'd sometimes been quite frightened, you know, in her presence or of her. But when I began to think about her as a woman, and I thought about those orange pots, and I thought about the way for women, our pots are really an external extension, I think, an external expression of our womb. It's a way for us to carry on nurturing our children and family and people that we love once they're outside our bodies. And then I thought of the ways in which pots are also the universal symbol of the way women carry on hoping in war during the Great Depression. You think of women carrying their few belongings and on top of it a pot. And that what that represents is that as long as a woman has her pot, she has the hope that she can nurture and take care of her babies. She can wash a baby, she can boil water, she can clean herself. And I knew that that was going to be the backbone of this book, that those pots, there's a photo of them right at, actually at the end of the book.
Did it sadden you or surprise you or some combination of the two that your mother thought of your first memoir as that awful book?
Yeah, you know, I was surprised because I think like most... look, my mother considered that God had given her a pair of ovaries for one reason only, and that was to produce a biographer. And so she read the entire works of Shakespeare in the womb to my older sister when she was just a fetus, and the upshot of that is my sister's functionally, willfully illiterate. I mean, to the point that even vocabulary's a little bit dodgy for Vanessa, so... like, for example, when we were growing up, she would keep muddling up difference between a hitchhiker and a hijacker. And it was a distinct difference. And then, well, the year, my dad's 72, but the whole year that he was 69, he kept saying, "That's it, I've done my 70 and I'm going to die next year." So we all had to troop out to the tree that he wanted to be buried under. And then Mum chose the tree she wanted to be, because my mum, never to be left out of a drama, chooses the tree she wants to be buried under. And Dad considers it's a little bit close to his tree, and he moves his tree.
If I recall correctly, he was concerned that that your mom's dogs would
dig him up. Not an unreasonable concern. So afterwards, we're sitting around having a few drinks under the tree of forgetfulness, and Vanessa says... You know, you get slightly hammered and maudlin, and we're talking about my dad's funeral, and with Dad intercepting that he doesn't want anyone jumping in the grave after him, least of all the dogs. And Vanessa goes, "Oh God, Bobo, I can't stand it. When Dad dies, you're going to have to do the urology." So she was not going to be writing anything, and so it sort of fell on my shoulders to write the book. I actually was not going to take on my mother as a subject because she's scary. I mean, the woman's certifiably crazy. She drinks a lot and she can handle an Uzi submachine gun. So I had written 10 novels and they were wildly unsuccessful. I was rejected by every major and minor publishing house in the country, and then my agent fired me. And then my ex-husband left. You know, he didn't leave permanently at that point. But he left to go and climb active volcanoes in Mexico, that being preferential to living with a suicidal, rejected writer. And on his computer, though, he left an envelope that said, "Only to be opened in the event of my death." So I did wait till he got to the bottom of the driveway before I ripped it open, and it was so boring. It was blah, 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 mortgage, yabba, 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 insurance. But it did say, you know, "I think you should just write the truth." And so I wrote... the bulk of "Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight" as a way, really, I recently become a U.S. citizen, and in a way, it was for me to say, you know, to my children, this is where I'm from, because I knew there's really no way that you could sit down and tell them those stories. I mean, there really is no. I realized that kind of, in a way, retrospectively, what had happened to Mum is we don't actually tell our children who we are, and they don't ask us that. Bit of our relation, we drop in. Our children drop into us midlife and then drop out again, and you don't sort of tell them, and plus they're not interested. By the time they're old enough for you to be able to tell them anything, they're so hormonal, they can't hear. So, you know, they're, and then by the time, you know, then you have your own babies and that sort of thing, and we don't catch up with our parents.
I think anyone who reads this or either of your previous books that played out in Africa would say that your love for where you are from is evident in your writing. But you also capture, I think, what seems like the absurdity of Africa. Did you feel like you had to guard against the kind of romanticism that you describe in your mother and her feelings toward Kenya?
Yes. When I was growing up, the really interesting thing was that, I mean, my formative years took place in a civil war. And the interesting thing about war, like a lot of things that human beings find hard to justify, they put the onus on God and say that God's on their side and it's God's plan. And I just think that's really handy because God isn't really available for comment, at least not, you know, it's a public open comment. You may have a private conversation with them. But and so, yeah, we were in this civil war. God was on our side, but he must be very busy because he seems to be on everyone's side. And intrinsic, I think, in keeping us fighting was this idea that we were fighting not only to keep Rhodesia sort of white run, because that was the big good plan, but also that there was no country like ours. Because otherwise, how could you justify the death and the horror and the violence unless your land was really, truly God's land? And so I grew up with this oversaturation of romance. And then, of course, my mother was saying, oh, well, if you think Rhodesia's marvelous, actually it's quite tatty compared to where I'm from. I'm from Kenya, blah, 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 right? So I was like, wow, I mean, if Rhodesia's the pinnacle, how much more pinnacle do you get? And I have to say, when I myself went, I call it Kenya, mother calls it Kenya, it's one of our political differences. And when I did go to Kenya and saw that amazing equatorial light, and I went back and I said to Mum, wow, you're right, that the light is, there's something about that, just golden light. And my mother said, oh, absolute rubbish, you can't possibly have seen the light. It left when I left the country. So she's great, my mum. It would be a crime against humanity not to write about her, really. But I think that writers are born more than they're made in a lot of ways, because from a very early age, I remember sort of being the one looking around and going, wait, hang on a minute, everything is not paradise. This is not all super groovy. And then that disease of nostalgia and the way of not seeing the cost of the romance was something I definitely wanted to write against.
Why was it important for you to include a playlist at the end of this book?
Oh, I just thought it would be fun. I think one of the things as literature that makes my mother interesting is that she would be easy to make a caricature of her. But she's very racist. She drinks too much. She's an appalling mother, for heaven's sake. She put her small child in an insecticide drum. Definitely got her pitfalls as a mother. But what makes her really interesting as literature is the places in which every reader can see themselves in her, the ways in which we are a contradiction. None of us are black and white. None of us are all good or all bad. Very few of us have to pay for our prejudices as much as Mum did. And a lot of us have beliefs which over time we get lazy and our beliefs calcify into prejudice, and we use our beliefs and our prejudice as a sort of self-protective shield against the world so that we don't have to hear people who have different opinions from ours. My mother doesn't have any of those luxuries. She lives surrounded by a village of 60,000 Goba people in an incredibly hot, inhospitable place. She has lost 5 children by any count. She's lost several farms. She's lost her mind. She's lost at least one war, she would say. And yet, the thing that I'm a knee-buckling awe of her for is she wakes up in the morning to her own soundtrack, and it features a lot of Frank Sinatra and Doris Day. And that takes huge amounts of guts and optimism.
You live in Wyoming, and have for some time. Is there anything in Wyoming and anything in your life there that resembles where you're from?
Well, Mom and Dad came out to stay with me, and my dad loves to fish, so I bought him a day with a cowboy to go fishing. And I said, and on the Green River, I don't know if anyone's been out of Green River, very famous for fishing, also really famous for mosquitoes. So I said to Dad, look, there's a mosquito issue, you might want to dress for it. Oh, I come from Africa, not all mosquitoes can't, blah, blah, blah. So Dad shows up to this fishing binge dressed as a Zambian banana farmer. So he's got these wafty Bermuda shorts and a bush hat. And the cowboy that's going with him has got, you know, denim tucked into leather and a handkerchief and a hat pulled down. My dad is slightly overdressed, isn't he? And I said, just you wait, Dad. I did warn you. It's your funeral. So anyway, he gets in the boat. And as my mother says, it was fantastic. Those mosquitoes swooped down like jackals and they siphoned every last drop of blood out of your father's body till it was just skin flapping against bone. So... She loved that. Actually, they kind of love... my mother, when Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight was written, and she was sort of trying to excuse the awful book, and she was so embarrassed. One of the sort of ways in which she managed to... There were a couple of ways she tried to get around that. One was by saying, well, Lunier, of course, Bilbo was probably switched at birth anyway, probably not my blood child. And then, you know, I pointed out I look exactly like her, so she was saying, that's right. And then she started telling everyone, well, you know, she's American, and they like to write books about how they weren't hugged enough as children, and then they go on the Oprah Springer show and cry about it. And so, but my mother actually loves the States. When she came over with my sister, the illiterate one, to visit me a few years ago, but if you're not a U.S. citizen, you've got to fill out this form when you fly over here. It says, are you now, or have you ever been a Nazi, or are you now, have you ever been a communist, or are you a terrorist, do you plan to blow up the country? And Vanessa, you know, being illiterate, didn't bother to read it, so she just wrote, yes, 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 yes. So she gets to Newark, and my mother said, it was fantastic. The Border Patrol swooped down, and the man had to waddle because he had a gun strapped to every limb and probably up in his orifice. And he frog marched your sister away to this little room, and I could see in the slit of the glass it was just your sister and 1,000 weeping Mexicans. It was fantastic. So Mum really approves of this country. And I'd say when I first got here, I felt... I mean, I was very excited to be here because I knew that in the States you had freedom of speech. And that, as my ex-husband said, just because you've now got freedom of speech, you don't need to use it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He said, you know what, you're like the nouveau riche of freedom of speech. Those of us who've had it for a few generations are a bit more tasteful about it. So I was very excited to be here, but it's funny because I was just writing about this afternoon. The depths of my loneliness knew no end. And I think that we don't realize that about immigrants, that we speak in cultural shorthand all the time. We assume that people come from our backgrounds, and so there's a shorthand for your experience growing up, various television shows. Like cling film, for example. People put cling film on everything. I didn't. I just was happy to have a fridge. I shoved my leftovers in the fridge. And it wasn't until I sort of got teased for... My mother calls it cling fling, not putting cling fling over everything. And why would you put a plastic bag in your rubbish bin and your garbage can? It's rubbish, for heaven's sake. And so this whole idea that you wrap your rubbish in more rubbish, I just couldn't... You know, there was a lot of things that were just sort of sarcasm I find incredibly baffling. I'm the sort of person who, when someone says something sarcastic, says, in my head, I think, gosh, that seems unlikely, but I say, really? And so there are sort of differences that take getting used to, and it really wasn't until I wrote The Legend of Colton H. Bryant, which was about a Wyoming cowboy, and I spent years out on the oil patches of Wyoming and in that sagebrush and talking to cowboys, that I began to feel that I had earned my way onto the earth here, and that I sort of fell in love with Wyoming in the same organic way that I love Africa, parts of Africa.
Well, on that note, Alexandra Fuller, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Writer Alexandra Fuller recorded on stage at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee this summer. Her latest book is called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Fuller grew up in Africa. She now lives in Wyoming. And there's a link to our full conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Monday's show. Tomorrow, the little-known story of Maitland Field, Milwaukee's old downtown lakefront airport. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.